important issue. For some of you, you do know, and for those who don't, I'm the immediate past president of the Community Cancer Center in Roseburg, Oregon. I've spent 12 or 15 years serving on the full board there and the executive committee and through the ranks. I find that cancer care in rural areas is critically important. In Southern Oregon, the Community Cancer Center treats patients from all over our area, as well as many patients from around the West, as we do contracted care for the Veterans Center in Roseburg. We're one of the only accredited cancer care facilities. I think we are the only accredited cancer care facility in Oregon, so we're quite proud of our facility. So with that, it brings us pleasure to bring to you a bill that makes the month Colorectal Cancer Month. Colorectal cancer is the third most common form of cancer and one that is very preventable and survivable when caught in its early stages. The purpose of this bill, H.J.R. 34, and its companion in the Senate, S.J.R. 9, is to call this to the attention of the people of Oregon, hopefully creating greater awareness, thus encouraging more people to seek the screening needed to prevent and treat this cancer. The end result will be to save lives and improve the quality of people of Oregon. And of course, that's always a very good thing. Serving on the board at the local center, I know personally the importance of screening to avoid and detect more serious consequences. I can tell you personally of friends and neighbors who have been saved by that process and treated and are upright and talking about it today because of that early treatment. There are many myths about colorectal cancer, and most people are uncomfortable even talking about it. And so some of those myths include: colorectal cancer is just as common among women as men. This year, about 150,000 Americans will be diagnosed with colorectal cancer, and more than 55,000 will die from the disease. In many cases, colon cancer can be prevented. Colon cancer almost always starts with a small growth called a polyp. If the polyp is found early, doctors can remove it and stop cancer before it starts. Another myth: African Americans are not at risk for colon cancer. Truth: African American men and women are diagnosed with and die from colon cancer at higher rates than men and women of any other racial or ethnic group. Colleagues, I could go on. There's a number of issues that I would like to bring to the attention of the people of Oregon, but this bill will do that. We're coordinating with the Senate in an effort to have both of these bills on the floors of our respective bodies on the same day next week so that we can get as much attention as possible. Our cooperation here and in our respective bodies will send a message on the importance of colorectal cancer screening to all Oregonians. I know there are people here from the American Cancer Society if there are specific questions on cancer screening. Colleagues, I urge you to move this to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
My name is Mel Cheney. I am the Executive Director of the Community Cancer Foundation and Community Cancer Center in Roseburg, Oregon. Madam Chair, honorable members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak to you this morning on a subject of great importance to all of us. When I was very much younger than I am today, the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Tip O'Neill, made the now famous and often quoted statement that all politics is local. The wisdom of that statement lay in its simplicity and truth. Old Tip realized that the issues that are really important to people are those that are close to home and that directly impact their lives. I would suggest that cancer easily falls into that category. One out of three Americans will develop cancer at some point during their lifetime. There is not a family here in Oregon that has not, in one way or another, been touched by this dreaded disease. The resolution before you today asks you to recognize that colorectal cancers, although very prevalent and deadly, are easily detected and easily treated. In fact, the 5-year survival rate with appropriate treatment of early stage colorectal cancer is over 93%. However, if undetected and treatment is delayed until the latter stages, when it has spread to other organs, the 5-year survival drops to less than 10%. Another great American politician, this time from the other side of the political aisle, the late Senator Everett Dirksen, stated that $1 billion here and $1 billion there, and pretty soon you're talking real money. I'm sure that as legislators, you are constantly bombarded with facts and figures and a never-ending request for money. This morning, I have deliberately tried to avoid presenting too many statistics to you. The numbers are already there in the resolution and in the handouts that I would like to distribute later. Also, I would point out that this resolution is not asking you for money, but only recognition and support so Oregonians can help themselves combat this deadly disease. Please help us in this endeavor. In the words of our Community Cancer Center Foundation president, a politician whom I greatly admire, Representative Bruce Hanna, please do it for your friends, for your neighbors, for your loved ones. Thank you very much for your permission to speak to you, and I'd like to distribute some literature pertaining to colorectal cancer. One of the documents that I will ask to be distributed, the cover here, brings the statistics down to a level on Douglas County. You see a lot of U.S., you see Oregon. When you open up to, say, the June calendar site, it will show what's actually happening in rural county right here in Oregon. I would also bring to your attention on line 3 of your joint resolution 34, there's a typographical error. It says county, and probably you should read country on that. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions of either of our two witnesses? Thank you, gentlemen. Oh, Representative Hanna.
Pardon me, Madam Chair. Director Mel Cheney did find that little error in the bill, and my staff, Bob Avery, has actually contacted the drafters to get that fixed. So.
And I think that we may be able to do a conceptual amendment here. I'm looking at it. Okay. Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much. Oh, wait. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Hanna and Mr. Cheney for coming forward with this resolution. My father is a survivor of colon cancer because he got a screening early.
Great.
So we need to let people know that, so thank you.
Great. Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. Courtney Dresser?
For the record, I'm Courtney Dresser with the American Cancer Society, and I'll be very short and sweet. I think everything that needed to be said has been said very well. But there's not very many times where we get to thank everybody so publicly, and I wanted to take the opportunity to thank a few people. Representative Hanna and Chair Domey are the ones who helped us on the health side get this drafted and bring this resolution to you all. And we would like to thank them for their assistance, and especially on all the timing issues of trying to get, as Representative Hanna said, trying to get this done at the same time on the Senate and the House. On the Senate side, and he wasn't able to join us today, but Senate President Peter Courtney has been a long-standing sponsor of bills that have to do with colorectal cancer screening. He is the one, I would say, the one person why we have a law in the state that requires insurance companies to cover the preventative screenings of colorectal cancer. So we want to publicly thank Senator Courtney for all of his efforts. And I think, as was mentioned, and why we brought this up and why we're trying to build as much awareness as possible around this issue, one, because March is our colorectal cancer month for the American Cancer Society. Nationally, we have ads out on TV and things like that. We try to build as much awareness as possible. But the reason why is because of the survival issue. If caught early, as Representative Kodak just said, you have the opportunity to basically become a survivor and live cancer-free. So the problem, though, is about only 39% of those cancers are diagnosed at that early stage. So that's why we have to do this, and we have to build as much awareness as possible. So we appreciate your vote for this and moving us to the floor next week.
Thank you, Ms. Dresser. Any questions of this witness? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill or resolution? All right, I'm closing the public hearing on HJR 34 and opening up a work session on HJR 34. Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that HJR 34 be amended by changing the word county to country on line 3 of page 1.
Representative Gelser moves that the word county on line 3 be changed to country. Any question, any discussion, any dissent? All right. Do I need to say that's been accepted?
You need a vote. You need to vote on the amendment.
We don't. We don't need a voice vote, do we?
Good. You should. Okay. You can either do voice or vote.
All right. So all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So now I do this.
You need to state that the amendment has been adopted.
The amendment to change county to the word country on line 3 has been adopted. And Legislative Council has advised that this conceptual amendment is appropriate. So,
and Madam Chair, I move that House Joint Resolution 34 as amended be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gelser moves that House Joint Resolution 34 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We need discussion.
Chair, it should be adopted as amended, as a resolution. You may have said that, but just for the record,
okay.
You repeated it should be adopted.
Representative Gelser moves that HJR 34 as amended be adopted and sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation, right?
You don't need one more due pass, but
okay.
I think you covered it.
Okay. Any discussion? Susan, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative
Kosek?
Aye.
Representative
Maurer?
Aye.
Representative
Olson? Aye. Chair Lane? Aye. HJR 34 as amended has been adopted, right? Not quite right.
Let's read this.
The committee has moved that HJR 34 as be sent to the floor as amended and be adopted, correct?
I have written.
I will close the, and I'm going to close the public, or the work session on HJR 34. Okay, I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 42. And Senator Morissette. Thank you for waiting, Senator.
You want me to introduce anything?
Yes.
Madam Chair, just to summarize Senate Bill 42. Senate Bill 42 would direct the Department of Human Services to adopt rules to grant exceptions to the requirement that all licensed adult care foster homes have a live-in provider. It would enable the residents of foster care facilities to be home alone for periods of time without direct supervision. It would also require DHS to adopt standards that safeguard the health and safety of residents and to ensure that the services they receive are uninterrupted.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. Thank you very much for hearing Senate Bill 42. I know it's similar to a House bill that you passed. This would expedite it to the floor, or to the floor of the House and then to the governor for signature. I worked on this bill for over a year with Tim Baxter, who is sitting next to me, and a woman by the name of Gretchen Thielman, who is a provider in Junction City. We had a number of hearings during the interim. I met with the Attorney General's office as well as with James Tace trying to resolve this issue, even looking at original legislative intent. The bill was introduced before developmentally disabled people were included in the foster home system. There was no alternative but to do the bill. So it's a very simple bill, and I do appreciate the fact that you are hearing this bill, and we'll move it along, and I just wanted to thank you again, and I would like Tim Baxter to have an opportunity to say, Tim has worked tirelessly on this issue.
Thank you, Senator.
Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I am Tim Baxter. I work for Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center, a private nonprofit legal service for low-income people in Eugene. I want to thank the committee and particularly Representative Gelser for its work on its own House Bill 2027, which this committee amended and passed out and which has passed the House floor. Advocates who represent, at least in my area, foster home providers and residents, want whichever bill can reach the finish line first to get there as quickly as possible. Until this is signed into law by the governor, residents are still being prohibited from being able to be in their own homes alone for specified periods of time. I do want to express my appreciation to the Department of Human Services. They have said, and I think reasonably and necessary, that folks that were certified for home alone variances must go through a recertification process, and now a year later, I think that's a prudent thing to do, but we appreciate the fact that they have told local offices that the local offices can proceed now to work up those recertifications for each resident so that by the time a bill becomes law, hopefully all that will be left to do is to sign off on the work that's already been done. And I know that Lane County has gone ahead. I hope that all of your respective areas, your local offices, are doing the same. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of these two? Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to express my appreciation to Senator Morissette, who has worked extremely hard on this issue from the time that it became a problem. So thank you for your leadership and helping to make this happen so quickly for the clients and for the providers that are desperately waiting for this change. Thank you, Tim. I know you've worked very hard as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Comment? Thank you, gentlemen. We have Lori Lindberg and John Mullen.
Chair Tomei, representatives of the committee, my name is Lori Lindberg. I'm the manager of DD Licensing Unit with Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 42. As you've already heard previously in testimony in January on this issue and again today, this helps us restore reinstate a process that we were doing in developmental disabilities prior to being advised that we perhaps should not have been doing that. It will allow some specific individuals, residents of adult foster homes, to remain home alone after we have assured that they have the appropriate skills to remain at home, and as long as the adult foster home provider remains supervising the home, is in contact with the home, and that they have gone through the appropriate measures to do that. It also allows us to, on occasion, grant exceptions to the live-in requirement to adult foster homes. This is important in some select situations, occasionally with homes that require additional staffing and have more intense staffing needs, and it sometimes makes it more difficult to have a live-in provider, although we do require that the provider and the shift caregivers that are in those homes meet the same standards that the adult foster home provider is meeting. So we believe that the residents are safe and the well-being is met. And so in summary, we are in support of this bill and appreciate the efforts of everybody who've worked on this.
Thank you. Any questions of this witness? Thank you very much. Mr. Mullen.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen from the Oregon Law Center, as long as my voice holds up. Pardon me. I just have a couple of very brief comments to make. First of all, very much in support of the bill. I think that the work that was done during the interim was exemplary to rectify a problem that exists. I pointed out when testifying on the House bill that there are the issues of adult foster care for people that have physical disabilities and seniors in long-term care situations where this was not intended for that population. The department also testified briefly in that regard. Just wanted to say that continue to be concerned about that aspect to make sure that those that have need for 24-hour care are not part of this particular discussion. But I believe that this is a well-thought-out bill that will serve the people
what it's intended for. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mullen. Any questions? Thank you both very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on this bill? All right, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 42 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 42.
Yes, I would move that Senate Bill 42 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gelser moves Senate Bill 42 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Susan, will you call the roll?
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative
Gelser?
Aye.
Representative
Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative
Sotek?
Aye.
Representative
Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye.
Representative.
Sorry, go ahead. I think I interrupted you before you declared that this passed. Okay. Senate Bill 42 passes with the due pass recommendation to the floor. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to recommend that, given that we've already voted on this bill in the other form on the House, I have the privilege of carrying it, that perhaps this time we can put it on the consent calendar.
Any discussion? Any concern? Susan, this will be on the consent calendar. I've closed the public hearing on, or the work session on Senate Bill 42, and I will open up an informational meeting regarding DHS collection and management system. Maybe. I need a carrier for HGR 34. Representative Kotek. Thank you, Susan. We are wanting to have an informational hearing. Is anybody here from DHS to talk about the data collection and management systems? Seeing no one here, and I've lost my administrative assistant. Yes.
The amendments are, at least mine are available.
Are I'm they?
Assuming yours.
Okay. We're going to take a 5-minute recess.
You're right.
I wasn't sure if the need will carry for the joint resolutions because I don't think we can handle it.
We can give regardless. Reopening the informational hearing on data collection and management systems. So, gentlemen, thank you for coming over. Data collection and management systems. So, gentlemen, thank you for coming over.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Faribor Spaksaraj. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the Department of Human Services. With me today is Rick Howard, Interim Chief Information Officer for Office of Information Services. And we're expecting Jim Joyce momentarily. He's a project manager for the MMIS project, the Medicaid Management Information System. Our presentation today is in three sections, and we'll try to be brief. You have a printed PowerPoint presentation. In front of you, our intent is not to go through every single chart, because there are quite a few, and I know your time is limited and precious, so we'll be mindful of that. I will provide a high-level overview of DHS information systems and services. Rick Howard will provide you with how we do IT costing and data collection. And then Jim Joyce, hopefully as soon as he gets here, he'll provide you with an overview and update on the MMIS project.
Great. And if you're going through any material here, would you let us know what page you're on?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Let's begin with page 4. Actually, page 4 and 5, charts 4 and 5, have a visual representation of IT functions within the Department of Human Services prior and after to creation of the Office of Information Services. You can see that prior to 1996, IT functions were resident in each business division. And under that method, you can see that IT function was siloed and was not really connected and not working harmoniously. After the creation of Office of Information Services, those IT functions were pulled into centralized managed units. What we have tried to do since then was to work together and to take the best advantage that we can of staff competencies, staff skills, and to work in conjunction with our customers to try to deliver the best IT services. The next chart, chart 6, demonstrates that historically the priority of the department has been focused on the program divisions and technology infrastructure supporting things like financial systems, forecasting analysis, security, and personnel has been a secondary focus. Chart 7, again, is a visual representation of the largest and most complex IT systems that we have in Department of Human Services. You can see that our oldest systems date back to almost 30 years. Food stamp management information system and the child welfare system, and shortly following those are client process monitoring systems, CPMS, and MMI. All in all, you can see that we have over 250 systems and applications in DHS written in 22 different languages, 9 different database types, and 5 separate platforms. Chart 8 has a listing of the technology challenges that we face in DHS, and the several following charts summarizes what those challenges are and what are the mitigating steps that we have taken in order to address those challenges. Chart 9, basically in summary, this chart is indicating that a variety of programming languages, databases, networks, servers, operating systems, and non-standard technologies significantly increase cost of ownership and maintenance and create a complex process which results in a slower response to customer issues. To address these, Chart 10 indicates that we have put in place a set of review and technology standards, and we've made sure that we are keeping our hardware and software current and updated so that our customers can be supported in the best way possible and have their business needs addressed. We have also substantially reduced the number of desktop images that we're using in DHS from 69 to 20 within the past few years. Chart 11 shows the challenges that we face in a siloed environment. And you can see that we have a number of independent databases. And when you use a single point solution to resolve issues, that always increases the time that we would spend in looking for data. It decreases accuracy and also productivity. To deal with that, we have attempted to combine databases. This is on chart 12. We do know that ultimately the solution to this thing is creating a single client database. We are working toward that, but it is a significant undertaking and challenge. We'll keep you posted on our progress as we move forward.
May I interrupt?
Absolutely.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, a quick question. Sure. Are all of these systems proprietary to DHS, or are they systems that are contracted that you bought licenses for?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, we have a combination of systems. Some of these are, for example, the biggest legacy IT systems that we have are unique to DHS. There are smaller applications that we have bought. Certainly in all of those cases, we have purchased licenses. But there are smaller applications that you might say they're off-the-shelf systems. But again, you know, having over 250 systems, we have all kinds and shapes.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So going back to chart 12, we have also formed an IT governance structure and have put a business case process in place in order to have a more enterprise approach to IT investments. Chart 13 shows the challenges that we face in these legacy systems, systems that are old. They're huge and complex. They're very expensive to operate. They don't easily integrate with other systems, whether they are within DHS or with enterprise systems. We spend a lot of time maintaining these systems. And what happens is that we have a backlog of customer requests that we cannot address in a timely manner. To deal with that, we have taken some steps to to replace some of our older systems. Right now, we are in the process of putting in place a new MMIS system. In fact, that is the biggest IT system that we have within the state of Oregon. We are also in the process of initiation of a project to replace our child welfare system. The RFP on that project is in the works and is scheduled to be released within the next couple of months. What Chart 14 also indicates is that we have adopted a buy versus build strategy. What we have recognized is that as the information technology becomes more complex, it is very difficult to develop and maintain competencies in a very complex technical infrastructure, and so we are basically stopping building systems because we don't have those competencies. The private sector can do that much more effectively.
Representative Gelster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With the upgrade of the Medicaid Management Information System, will that be able to duplicate or replace things like CPMS, which is what the client processing management system that might cover services to clients that are not Medicaid reimbursable? Will it be a holistic program?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, no, that will not. It's only for Medicaid. So I'll actually defer to Rick Howard. He has a much more in-depth knowledge in MMIS. So, Rick, go ahead.
Introduce yourself.
Yes. For the record, my name is Rick Howard. I'm the Interim Chief Information Officer for the Department of Human Services.
Pull it. Thanks.
There are portions of CPMS which will be replaced, those that render Medicaid services for that population, and there are portions that will not be the system. The CPMS system will stand alone for some time in the future. The funding streams for the Medicaid Management Information System are very clear about the Title 19 and Title 21 populations, so the degree that services that are being rendered through the CPMS system for the Medicaid clients, some of those functions will be rolled into the MMIS.
Can I follow up? I think that the source of my question, I worked at DHS for a while over at SPD, and I think about the way to access information. And CPMS, I would monitor expenditures in the program that I was working on, and every month I would get that big printout stack from CPMS. And there wasn't a way to search it electronically, so I would spend hours going through with highlighters, looking through page by page of this giant stack, and then to compare what other services they were receiving not in that service element, I would have to walk down a hallway to look up that person's case provider number in another hard copy folder and then make a request to the appropriate information officer to be able to run the information to pull it out of a different type of process. Is there any hope that there might be a more holistic way of operating these systems so that technology could be used to take what could be a two-day process into just a couple of hours?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, the answer to your question is, this is a great question because these are legacy systems and we face the kind of problems that you're describing in many of those systems. One of our hopes is that, specifically with MMIS, the new system is supposed to address many of those issues because it is based on a modern platform and it allows for data exchange and for access to information much easier than what you're describing. With many of these old systems, you're still facing the printout reports, the green bar reports, mm-hmm. as you might, that come in truckloads, frankly. We are trying to get away from those, but again, these are huge systems that are not easy to replace. In the case of MMIS and SACWIS, we're talking about millions of dollars of investment to replace these systems. But that is the intent that we have. Again, the problem has been created and has been twofold. One, because of the age of these systems. Specifically in the case of CPMS, we're talking about a system that's nearly 30 years old right now. But also because historically we had taken a siloed approach to creating systems that only address mm-hmm. one problem in one division. And we can't do much about that, you know, what has happened in the past. What we can do is, from this point moving forward, some of the efforts that we have engaged in, where possible, we have put modern front ends on these older systems to create some of the capabilities to make receiving reports and distributing information easier. Where that's possible, we do that, but where it's not, again, we're looking at replacing these systems, and again, because of the size of these systems, we have to do it in cycles. So we can only do one or two at a time.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Thank you, Tony.
So going back to charts 15 and 16, these two charts address the issues of governance. And that chart 15 basically indicates that inconsistent processes in organizing and approving requests, combined with lack of strategic planning and considering the bigger picture, causes lack of coordination and poor return on investment. And to address that, in chart 16, we're indicating that we have created an Information Technology Governance Council that oversees all of the IT investment and activities within the department. We have also created the next level, the Information System Management Group. This is a combination of people who use technology, the users of information technology, and people who are providing those services. And by bringing these folks together, working together on the same committee, we are trying to create a standard approach to requesting technology changes. Another thing that we have put in place within DHS is a business case process. Any IT project that's being initiated needs to have a business case that clearly demonstrates the risk that is involved in that project, what's the investment, and what is the value to the public. And finally, we're attempting to do all this in collaboration with all of the divisions. The next two charts, 17 and 18, is a graphical representation of the skills currently required to operate and maintain the systems in the current environment and the competencies that we need to have when we move to the new environment. And as you can see by comparing those charts, there's quite a bit of different competencies that's required to move from the current environment to the future environment. As you can see, in the new environment, there are some pieces of the pie that are getting bigger. For example, contract management. This is one of the most important functions in procuring and implementing IT systems. Especially now that we have gone to a buy versus build strategy, we need competent contract administrators to be able to work with the contractors and make sure that the project is successful. Another piece is the business process engineering, which is a very small piece of the pie in the current environment. But as you all know, quite often we invest in very expensive information technology solutions without really having the business ready to use those solutions. And this effort is to get the business ready for the new environment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you. Excuse me for interrupting you, but I'm not very good in this world. So could you explain to me on page 17 the abbreviations, what COBOL stands for?
Oh, I'm sorry.
And DBA and SA?
Yes, I'm sorry about that.
Probably my lack of knowledge.
Oh, no, actually, I should have done a better job. Database analyst and system analyst.
Okay.
And there was another one?
COBOL.
COBOL developers. COBOL is a legacy programming language. It's the oldest programming language that we have. And again, it dates back to the earliest systems, and it is rarely or never used in newer systems. So again, because most of our systems are legacy systems, we need to have a large number of COBOL developers and programmers who can make changes to those old legacy systems.
When you're using the word legacy, you mean old, one that we have inherited over 30
years.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, basically we are really referring to three generations of technology. The legacy systems, COBOL would be part of those. And then the client server systems, which is the next generation of technology. And then a newer technology, which is the web, which is the smallest piece of the systems that we have right now in DHS. But we are hoping to reduce significantly the legacy systems area and move more into the newer system technology. The final chart that I would like to cover is chart 19 that shows what business plan themes the OIS, Office of Information Services, has adopted in order to overcome the challenges that I shared with you. There are basically six business themes that are highlighted, actually in bold letters on the left. Well, in order to do this, we have to modernize our systems. We have to create enterprise solutions and start collaborating, and not only within the department with our divisions, but also outside the department with other state agencies. One example of that is the Scenic Project and the State Data Center that has taken over the computing resources and the network services for the Department of Human Services. We no longer perform those services. That is now performed by the State Data Center. We have to be able to transform our skills to move into this new environment. We have to be able to do a decent job, a great job, in relating to our customers and addressing their needs. To do all of this requires a culture change, because we are talking about basically transforming the IT environment that we are operating in. And last but not least is process improvement. Quite often we throw technology solutions to broken processes, and by doing that we are only making mistakes faster. So it is our hope that before we, and you know, it's interesting because quite often when that happens, then we go back and blame technology for the failures. So what we're hoping to do is to do a more comprehensive job in reviewing our processes and improving them before we apply technology. So I will stop there, and if there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer. If not, I'll turn it over to Rick Howard to cover the next section.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Mr. Howard.
Madam Chair, represent members of the committee, I am, again, for the record, Rick Howard, the Interim Chief Information Officer for the Department of Human Services. And my understanding today is to talk a little bit about our fiscal impact process, how we go about pricing some of the bills that come forward and have an IT component to it. So I'd like to begin on chart 21, which talked about a process that wasn't working so well in the first few weeks of the legislative session. We were often receiving input on these bills a little late in the process and had very short time frames in which to provide a reasonably accurate pricing for the fiscal impact of the information technology portion of that bill. We quickly identified that as an issue, and then as chart 22 points out, we did make a change, a minor change according to the chart, but a fundamentally different one, in that it provided us early warning of bills that were coming in, being turned over to the program, to the legislative coordinator, and then quickly being scanned for any potential IT impact, so that we had enough lead time to price out the IT dimension of that bill. So we are now involved earlier in the process in closing the loop with our the DHS finance and policy analysts, and then with the legislative fiscal office, to ensure that these initial price quotations are reasonable and relatively accurate given the requirements as we understand them as contained in the legislation.
What does ASD stand for?
That stands for the Administrative Services. Oh, sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Gelser. That stands for the Administrative Services Division of the Department of Human Services.
How many people work for the Department of Human Services?
Madam Chair, my understanding is approximately 9,500 people throughout the state.
Thank you. Okay.
On chart 22, I have outlined here the roles of the how we go about handling the bill process and the roles of the legislative coordinator within the Office of Information Services, what that legislative coordinator is supposed to be doing as a bill comes in, how they go about disseminating that bill to the folks who are closest to those data systems and understand the scope of work that would be required to meet the intent of the legislation, and then how it plays out into the area of the subject matter expert and how they go about getting really down into the code and looking at the types of modules, the number of interfaces between the multitude of systems that potentially come into play depending on the nature of the legislation. And they're coordinating in the entire time with the bill manager to ensure that we have a timely response to the legislation and returning the information as to the fiscal impact.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mount.
I'm Cowan.
Cowan, thank you. I knew there was a difference between you two.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm looking okay.
Okay, let's see. What was my question? I'm trying to flip back and forth between these two rather complex charts, and I, with apologies for the life of me, I can't figure out where the difference is between the two. Could you maybe just explain to us what the difference is in your process that makes it easier?
Yes. On chart 21, the box that highlights at what point originally the Office of Information Services was engaged in the conducting the legislative fiscal impact process. The bill was coming in and going through the programs and coming in at and sometimes in the final hours of the deadline to the Office of Information Services. We would find out from multiple sources, either through the program and their legislative coordinator, through within the Administrative Services Division or external to it through the, one of the other divisions of DHS, or through the business analysts, as low in the process as that might be, where they would suddenly occur to them that there's an information systems impact, and then that information would jump in toward the end of the process for a quick turnaround time from the technical experts who are to price out that bill. That is chart 21.
Representative Cowan, are you getting your question answered?
Not so far, but I'm hoping.
So
I don't see a difference. I just see a bunch of little boxes in
there. Yes, I apologize, Representative Cowan. On chart 22, there's an arrow that actually comes in earlier in that dotted circle.
Okay.
That arrow that comes in earlier, in effect, puts us right into the process.
There's one extra arrow right there. Okay.
It is a small and yet very significant part of this complex flow. Because that puts us back into the process much earlier, coordinating at the front end, scanning the legislation that comes forward, and doing our own quick take before the at about simultaneously with the program analysts to ensure that if we think that there is even a hint of information system impact, that we've got our staff deployed and working it earlier. A subtle distinction, to be sure.
I was never good with those puzzles that you had to find the difference in them either, especially when I was going back and forth.
Thank you.
Representative Cowan, I can appreciate that I, unfortunately, am more of a picture-driven person, and I had to make sense of the picture first and understand where was this, the process breaking down, why were we receiving these within hours of the deadline, and then really attempting to give a good faith effort for what is a rough order of magnitude estimate. Again, as we interpret the legislation, we can make certain assumptions about what is likely to occur, and then in the best faith effort, deliver a rough order of magnitude that we think we can deliver on without a great deal of variation in the ultimate pricing of that. So we have covered slide 23, which did talk about the roles and responsibilities. Again, something that has we've reaffirmed is the way the process is supposed to work and who's supposed to be doing what. Now into the meat and potatoes of how we go about pricing these bills is on slide 24. And so we have a series of questions or considerations that we take into any analysis that we undertake. Can the work be performed by existing staff? Do we have, and so the considerations there, do we have surplus capacity or that workloads could be adjusted to perform the work? it would be no surprise that as new work comes in, you have only so many options. You hire additional people to do the work that is expected. You seek to supplement your resources either through contracting or through the hiring of positions, depending on the duration of that work, or you defer existing work and through a prioritization method and do this work if it's determined to be more critical than the work that you're undertaking. So if we do not have excess capacity, we do look at the contracting option if it's a short-term immediate need. What's the level of effort to develop the solution? Again, is it duration has everything to do with it? Are we looking at something that can be done in 6 weeks or 6 months? What's the level of effort to maintain that work? Ultimately, sometimes it's simply working, reworking the code and automating certain processes, and there's very little long-term need to support that work. Other times there are new processes, new jobs are run, new people to monitor that may take some a level of effort beyond the immediate implementation of that. So we do consider, is this a one-time cost or are there longer-term requirements? How many staff will be needed? We do have a method for pricing that out, and again, based on our assumptions, what level of effort would be required. What are the IT skill sets? How long will that staff be needed, as I mentioned earlier? And would there be additional work space or equipment needed to complete that task? Often, there are multiple approaches. The intent of the legislation may be a particular outcome or a particular need, but internally on the process side, there are multiple ways and solutions potentially available. And so, again, working through the program, we determine what would be the preferred approach. Do we write a new module? Do we purchase a new solution? Do we modify existing code? These are all the considerations that we would ultimately affect the pricing of the implementing the intent of the bill. For comparative purposes, on slide 25, we have taken a look at what we would be likely to be paying on a contract rate versus what the State of Oregon Information System Specialist ranges what they would be. So you can see, coming back to the type of work that could potentially be required to implement a solution from the analysis portion of it all the way through to the programming and testing of it. There you can see kind of the different skill sets that we do have available to us through a managed service provider. In the event, for comparative purposes, that we were to deploy existing staff on it or have to hire somebody on either a limited duration position, you can see the range of salaries from ISS series, Information Systems Specialist series 4 through 8.
Are these by hour?
Yes.
And the smaller number is existing staff and the higher number is contract rate?
Representative, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that there are different levels. So program analyst 1, 2, or 3 may be, depending again on the type of program analysis you're looking for and the skill sets that are being sought, that the 27 or the 36 on the first line there on the contract rate would represent the lowest end, and 75 meaning if you were looking for someone with high skill sets and program analyst skill sets might be the upper end. On the ISS series, the 27 represents the lowest, and then 55 represents the highest.
But all
nine
of these are contract rates.
All except the last line that says State of Oregon, and those are based on our salary grades.
I see. Great.
Yes.
Thank you.
So you could fall anywhere in between there, depending on the type of work that you think you'd be contracting for.
Right. For
purposes of getting this into a single slide, we're showing the range that we're likely to see bump up against.
Thank you.
On slide 26, we're looking at the costing of the bills, and really it comes back down to that series of possible alternatives based on the legislation and the intent of it. Would we modify or enhance the system? Would we build a new system? Would we purchase some commercial off-the-shelf alternative? Would we replace the system? And so as the first set of points indicate, I was going back and forth between bringing in one of the recent diagrams that we have built with respect to our financial systems and the number of interfaces and the number of systems involved to pay a bill, the handoffs that occur from the initial system, which is, say, receiving the bill and processing it against the rules to make sure eligibility and service package is correct, to handing it on down to the state financial management system. There are a number of handoffs, but as you can see here in the bullets, in the case of the financial or accounting functionality, 23 separate systems can be engaged in order to ultimately draw down from the Treasury a bill that we're paying. That is the definition of legacy systems, where, again, we purchase a system to meet a particular need at a particular point in time, and then ultimately, as time moves forward, we find that we have multiple systems through which we have to interface among them in order to get the transaction completed. So, again, based on these program changes, the timing implications, depending on the scope of the work, really will depend on how many of those systems come into play. And so we did quickly on chart 27, my final chart, talking about House Bill 2407, and there was a disparity between the original costing of that bill and then the final costing of it, and it really had to do with whether or not we were able to tie this to the new MMIS system and how that would ultimately bring down some of the prices, as well as the idea that this population would come in under a federal waiver, in which case all those transactions could be tracked through the MMIS rather than the general fund transaction, which brings into play all of those 27 systems. So that, in a nutshell, is why you, depending on, again, how you can go about meeting the need and how much data system work would be required, that would highlight that level of disparity, general fund transaction versus one that would come in under waiver service and accounted for with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Representative Gelser?
So would that be true when thinking about programs? I'm thinking about another program that we've talked a lot about recently, which is the Healthy Kids program. And in revenue, we made an amendment that dropped the eligibility level from 350% to 300%. From that 300 to 350%, that would have been general fund, but by dropping it to 300%, it's all Medicaid match. Does that mean that there would be savings in that bill as well in the information technology because there wouldn't be that scaffolded general fund, the 23 extra systems?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, that would be my understanding. I'm not familiar enough with the Healthy Kids bill at this time to know exactly how the funding of that program would play out. But from what you've described, it would sound like that would fall into the standard Medicaid population, which is handled, both the transactions and the financing is handled through that system.
So could I do a follow-up? That's more of a question. I guess as I'm looking at this, and this is my bill, the House Bill 2407, and that was really enlightening to me how substantially a fiscal could change based on the implementation date and the interface with technology. It sounds like as policymakers, as we're looking at dates, as we're looking at eligibility points, that sometimes it really might make a difference in terms just of that technology impact that might not have anything to do with the program itself or the cost of providing the actual services.
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, that is largely true, although for 2407 the significant difference was in the fact that that population was originally envisioned to be paid for through general funds, bringing into play nearly 13,000 hours of work to enhance or modify the financial systems to account for that general fund transaction. There would be work to have modified both the old MMIS and the new MMIS, and those costs would remain the same. On the IT portion of it, we would not have had to do, based on the timing, the work on the old MMIS. We'll still have to do some work on the new MMIS. But the fact that now this is no longer a general fund transaction but a waivered service coming through the MMIS, that's the significant cost difference. We won't have to do all the 13,000 hours of work on all of the financial systems.
Isn't that appalling, 13,000 hours of work?
Okay. Thank you. And I might follow up with you later, because originally it was always a Medicaid service. There was just a chunk of the way that might have been a non-Medicaid service for a few hundred kids. And that's very overwhelming that we have information systems that would be so difficult to manage that could really create barriers to good programs where the cost of the actual service might be dwarfed by the cost of the technology to keep track of it. And I worry about that being a hindrance to good policy and good human service programs, that we're not providing services that perhaps we can afford and that our constituents need simply because of the costs of technology. And it seems like we're in a day and age when it should be simpler than 16,000 hours to keep track of a couple hundred kids.
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, your point is well taken. My only consideration there is whether you're paying $1 or $1,000 or $10,000 to have that data flow, the work would remain the same. And so whether it's one child or 1,000 children, it is certainly true that the work will go into it regardless of how big or little the program would be, and that would be a consideration. There are certainly alternatives as you begin to modernize your data systems that would at least keep the IT portion of the program to lower than it is today with these legacy systems.
And I recognize that these are enormous systems that aren't replicated in other places, but I'm thinking about the importance of technology in business and world affairs and state government and federal government. How do these costs compare to a place like Amazon that has to track shipping and tax laws in all sorts of different places for different sales taxes and different payment methods? Is this true in and out of government, that the cost of keeping track of different kinds of information is so...
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, this is actually a very important point, so I wanted to interject here. Two things. You actually went way beyond House Bill 2407, and what you're reminding us of is the importance of considering technology issues when you make policy decisions and business decisions. And I will get to the Amazon piece in just a moment, but a great example of what you just brought up is the changing of the daylight saving time without really consideration of what it would take to change the computer systems, and all of our agencies right now are struggling with that, and it has created a huge mess, you know, within our own IT systems, again, because we did not take the time to say what is the technology impact of this and how many thousands of hours are required for different software companies to create patches to fix that. So that's a very timely example. The biggest difference between Amazon and us is that they don't use legacy systems. That's written in COBOL. Technology, you know, especially nowadays, changes and moves so quickly. And our biggest challenge right now in this day and age is how to migrate from this old world. We cannot really abandon these systems, because these systems serve hundreds of thousands of Oregonians, millions of people. So we have to have a strategy, and we're doing it the best way we can. Meanwhile, if you have any suggestions on how we can do this better, we're always open to suggestions. But the point that you brought up, I just wanted to say that is one of our biggest challenges. Quite often policy is made without consideration to what the technology cost of that would be. And quite often, as Rick pointed out, we are asked to provide an initial estimate of what something would cost. And this is so difficult because you really don't know all the details. And so, you know, we are faced with a huge dilemma. On the one hand, if we are conservative on our estimates, we are accused of padding our estimates. If we are not conservative enough, we are basically putting ourselves in a situation that to have to do the job without the resources. So in a way, it's a no-win situation for us, but we hope that through this type of dialogue, a better understanding is established so that we can become better in the work that we do, and the policymakers can become more mindful of the technology impact and the costs on the policies that are made.
How can we do that? How can we when we're developing a bill, how can we interface with you to understand what effect this will have on IT?
Madam Chair, we have partially tried to do that. Within DHS, we have put a system in place to where every person who's dealing with a bill would have to look at a form, and the form basically asks, is there a technology impact? Part of the problem is that people don't know the answer to that. They may think that there is no technology impact. The other piece that can help us is really through these kinds of dialogues. What I'm sensing today is that we're having a dialogue. You know, you're not dictating to us. You're not, you know, telling us what to do. And the more that we can create that exchange of information and that dialogue, I think we would make significant progress toward that goal.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you. As the individual who couldn't find the arrow on a chart, obviously I'm learning a great deal from this presentation, and it strikes me as important for us to say from this direction that I, at least as someone who is looking at policy change, is interested in the dialogue as early as possible and interested in developing policy in a cohesive way with all of our challenges, but I'm pretty much ignorant of the technology impacts. So I would like to respectfully suggest that as we get into that process as early as possible and you're developing the fiscal impacts for us, if it could be accompanied by something that would give us some ideas of a simple change in the proposal, just as was being described, whether that be an implementation date or whatever else, that would be very helpful to me, rather than just seeing however many million-dollar fiscal impact. If I got an extra piece of information that said, but with this new technology we have online on this date, if you could just change the date a little bit, it would be very helpful. Something that would give us guidance as to how we could lower that impact, to me, would be very helpful as early as possible in the discussion.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, we will do our best to do that. Again, we are learning throughout this process, and it would help to know what we can do in order to help you make those decisions. And again, through these dialogues, we can learn, and we'll come back, and we'll make mistakes along the way, but, you know, we'll improve to the best extent we can in order to make your job easier.
Thank you. Representative Maurer.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that if good public policy is in any arena, whether it's human services or not, is to help people and help the state, then if IT is getting in the way of that, then maybe we need not have IT associated with that program. If we're attempting to help a couple hundred children in the state of Oregon, and it's going to cost you 19,000 or 16,000 man-hours to adjust your IT program, then maybe we don't need the IT program in this case. And that when we're dealing with hundreds of thousands of people or millions of people, then maybe it's a cost-benefit ratio that pays out. But if we're, you know, I dislike the idea that we're letting IT dictate public policy. And in the military, we do that an awful lot, but there's also opportunities to opt out of IT if it's not coherent or, you know, with or congruent with your mission. So I don't want this to end up being IT, you know, it's what, wag the dog kind of philosophy. So I'm interested in hearing more, but I don't want to get bogged down in IT as the answer, because I would assume that you would appreciate not having to deal with every little change. You want to deal with the big issues that really are cost effective.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, you're absolutely correct. What we have adopted as our philosophy in DHS is that IT is only an enabler. It is not the driver. It is the business and the policy that's driving, and we are only there to support that. But again, it is through these kinds of dialogue that we can create the kind of understanding in order to be able to answer your questions. This has been a long-standing debate, you know, between the people who are in the IT business and people who are actually working on the business side. And, you know, I actually have a great example to share with you. I think most or all of you know Jim Scherzinger, who's the deputy of finance for our organization. When he started with us just almost about a year ago, I think, you know, the tendency of some of us within the organization was to try to resolve the financial crisis that we were facing with an IT solution. And Jim really focused us and centered us, and he said, we're not going to throw any IT solutions to this problem. We're going to first figure out all the business processes and fix those before we ever talk about IT systems. And in fact, by doing that, we are probably millions of dollars ahead, because by throwing an IT, a large IT system at that finance problem that we had, we would have made it more complicated. This is a great example of where the business is leading, and we're basically following their guidance and advice. And as it comes to legislation, we are more than willing to do that. My question, when I sit down and talk to program managers, again, going back to this business case process that we have now put in place within the Department of Human Services, the question that we ask is, what are intent for applying IT? What is the cost? And ultimately, what is the benefit? And precisely going back to your case, if, for example, we're going to engage in a scanning process that's supposed to substantially reduce paperwork, and at the end I find out that the paperwork has increased, the question is, why did we do that? Why did we throw IT as a solution to this problem? Again, we have been learning, and I think we are becoming better. But I appreciate your comments. It's right on.
Thank you. President Pro Tem.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, gentlemen. This is a really interesting conversation, because I think many of us have been curious about how bills get costed in the Department of Human Services. So I think the transparency around the IT issue is really helpful. I guess I would be curious to hear from other aspects of the department and the assumptions and checklists they use when they're doing the costing. I think would be very helpful to know. But specifically, you were responding to, you talk about how you respond to bills that come to have some IT costs. In the policy option packages, I assume that IT considerations are included when those fiscals are developed. And I'm specifically thinking of an issue we've talked about in Ways and Means around relative foster care payments and whether or not to apply a means test. And I'm wondering if you get approached when there is some kind of eligibility test added to something, and the IT around that, is that then added into the fiscal as a cost? And, for example, if we didn't have a means test, it might cost less because we'd have less IT costs. I'm just wondering how that works internally.
Do you have to take that, or do you want me to ask?
Go ahead.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, we do have more time with policy option packages, so I think generally we do a better job in estimating IT costs around those. And again, we are becoming better at this, but I think most everybody within the department is aware, and when issues like that come up, they are brought back to Office of Information Services for consideration, so that we can, as accurately as possible, estimate the IT costs for the project and for the policy option package.
Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along the same line, when you talked a little bit about trying to move away from the idea of silos, of a new program or a new technology for every piece. As bills come before us and they have fiscals that are attached to them, how can we be sure that we understand which bills, if passed together, might have a lower cost, that the fiscals might come down because that information system might be applied to both of them, so that fiscal cost in a bill individually would be duplicated, but together you would reduce that cost by one. Is there a way for us to know and understand that, or to think strategically about how we package or sequence legislation as we move it through the process? And then, do you adjust the fiscal impacts as items move through the Ways and Means process if bills are passed and approved that would then decrease the fiscal on?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, yes, actually what you can do is simply ask the question. You can also expect us to exercise due diligence to make sure that we are doing that, because really that is our job. We need to be looking at where there are opportunities across the divisions to apply technology and reduce the cost. And yes, when those situations do occur, we do adjust the fiscal impact to reflect for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up to Representative Gelser. So would that be a request we would make of the Director's Office to let us know of the bills that are out there, which information systems are being impacted? I mean, I know some of these, but I could only guess at which ones are impacted, because if you're going to hire a contractor to do some changes, there's a chance of cost savings in terms of bundling projects. But so is that what we should request, to know which IT systems are impacted by bills specifically? Is that helpful?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotick, certainly you can do that, but that is happening internally right now. I mean, the Director's Office has already instructed us to exactly do that. Again, along the lines of transparency and accountability, they expect us to be looking at across the divisions and identify opportunities that exist for lowering costs, whether it is IT or program services, frankly. And but if you want those specifically pointed out, we can certainly do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's great. It sounds like you're doing it. It sounds like we just need to see the information that you've already collected. So thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, and I note that you've come here to testify also.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Joyce. I'm the project manager for the Medicaid Management Information System project. Today I'll be providing a short overview of the project and a status of the project. Over the last few years, DHS has provided status reports on the project to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology. Our last report was November of 2006, and I'll provide an update to that report today. I'm going to start on chart 30, which is to answer the question, what is an MMIS? A MMIS, or Medicaid Management Information System, is a federally required information system to manage the payments made through the Oregon Medicaid program. Currently, the Oregon Medicaid program makes approximately $3.1 billion in payments a year to over 30,000 Oregon Medicaid providers, which provides services to over 400,000 Oregonians.
Representative Bauer.
Can you repeat that first number? How many payments?
$3.1 billion in payments a year to over 30,000 Medicaid providers. That provides services to over 400,000 Oregonians.
Okay.
So it's a very large information system. It covers the services that are provided throughout the department. The diagram shows that the MMIS is more than just a claims processing system. Besides paying claims, it makes payments to managed care providers. It manages Oregon providers being added to the Oregon Medicaid program. It manages the services that we provide to those providers. It manages the clients that receive Medicaid payments and the eligibility verification for those clients. Because it's a federally required program, it also provides the reports required by the federal government for accountability of Medicaid payments that are made. Our current MMIS was implemented in 1982. Our current system is over 25 years old. Its technology was developed to handle the submission of claims on paper forms. Since 1982, the Medicaid health insurance business has changed significantly.
Do you get federal money to update your programs?
Yes. The MMIS, since it is federally required, the replacement of that system is funded at approximately 90% funding. In a few charts, I'm going to cover the current budget for the project and what the state share is and how we're supporting the state share of the replacement. Chart 31 talks about our approach for replacing the MMIS. The approach that we've adopted is to take a MMIS that is running and operational in another state, ask a contractor to modify that system to meet Oregon's Medicaid-specific needs. We are currently completed the procurement of our contractor, and our contractor is currently in the development and implementation phase. What I'm going to cover for you briefly are what are the goals and outcomes expected for the replacement, what are the contractors and budget involved in the project, and what are the benefits that we expect to receive as a result of completing the project. Let me start with the goals. From the initiation of the project, we initiated three major goals. Improving our administration of the Oregon Medicaid program, improving the performance of the system, and improving the impact on stakeholders of the system. Under the three major goals, we have 11 objectives, and each of these objectives have measurable outcomes that we measure before the project began, we'll measure when we've completed the project. The major objectives that we're tracking are assuring that the new MMIS is federally certified and meets the new HIPAA requirements. Also, we're tracking that the new system allows effectiveness and a department-wide implementation of business processes and systems to meet the needs. And third, that we improve the payment system for our Oregon providers. The next chart shows the schedule for the project. The schedule for the project has an initiation phase, a planning phase, and a development and implementation phase. As I mentioned to you earlier, we are currently in the development and implementation phase, specifically stage two, which is the development and of the changes needed from the system that is being transferred from Oklahoma. We're developing the needed changes to meet Oregon Medicaid laws and regulations, and we're currently in the process. We've completed requirements, and we're currently in the process of designing the system. We have projected to phase in the capabilities of the system into a phase three, enhancing the system to fully meet all of the department's Medicaid administrative needs. The next chart summarizes our current project budget. As I mentioned earlier, the replacement...
It was a question about the budget. In the $77 million total budget when it's done, does that cover only technology costs and new staff, or does that cover the time lost to both local providers and also policy staff over at the department, kind of spent in meetings, planning, collaboration in the development of the program?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Gelson, these costs are the costs to DHS staff and contractor staff that are working on actually changing and implementing the new system. These costs are not costs associated with costs for providers to make their necessary changes or for the business to assume new business processes. This does include the training cost for both providers and for DHS staff and other partners, but it does include documenting the new business processes to be used after the implementation of the new system. But the actual changes that need to be made by MMIS stakeholders is not within this budget.
Follow up. So when you say the costs for training are included, if a DHS policy person goes on a road show and they take 3 days to go off to the counties, does that cost include the 3 days of policy work that person isn't doing and the time away from clients that the local providers are giving up in order to participate in the training?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, first of all, the training is provided by our contractor.
Okay.
And so there isn't somebody from DHS who's been displaced from being able to do their everyday services. As we're replacing the system, we're in a position of having to do the business that we have to do every day with our existing staff. So we have augmented DHS with additional DHS staff and contractor staff that can manage the changes needed to the new system such that we can implement the new system as we are operating the existing system.
Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
To follow up with Representative Gelser's question, and when you talk about provider time, in the world I am in, we're not talking about state providers. We're talking about private providers that, and I have not seen the system, so I don't know, but I'm assuming that there's going to be a cost for those providers to change their business processes to meet the new needs of the state, and they don't have a choice.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, the changes primarily are providing additional capabilities. The changes that the new system, and I'm going to get to it in a chart or two, talk about the primary benefit to providers is allowing them to submit claims and check the status of their payments online. And so the primary training that we're going to be providing providers is this is how you get online, this is how you track your claims or your payment requirements, and this is how you can tell when you're going to get paid. And if there is a holdup in payment, if there is a denial of payment, here is where you can find the information, identify what changes need to be made, and resubmit. And so primarily it's because of the HIPAA rules identify standard transactions, we are changing the way that providers submit their request for payment. What we are providing is additional capabilities that will speed their ability to get paid more accurately and with a quicker response time.
Follow up to that, I hope you're going to change the way providers submit information, because going from paper, anything's better than a piece of paper and a first-class stamp. So that's my point.
It's more of a comment that I think one of the great benefits of MMIS is that ability to do that online transaction. If I think again about my experience at SPD, and one of the issues that SPD gets hit for is the forecasting of what the use of services is. But the delay that happens when you have a case manager that has to fill out a piece of paper and then give it to their local business manager and then ship it up to the state where it goes through the central offices person who's processing that piece of paper and then getting it entered in the system so that it can go to the program manager for approval, this really slows things up, and the opportunity for error is very significant because that's a lot of manual shifting of information. So I agree. This will be a tremendous benefit, and I think will help with the forecasting as well.
To continue, I was discussing the project budget. The chart outlines the numbers for the budget by phases as well as the total budget. It also identifies the percentage of federal and state funding required. The state funding on this project is paid through a certificate of participation, and the only general fund that is allocated to the project is the interest payments towards that COP cost. The project is currently governed by an executive steering committee. The project has over 30 full-time members working on the project. That's above and beyond our current operations. The current operations is involved in the process of replacing the system, though, because they are going to own the system when it gets implemented. We have over 300 participants throughout DHS that are working with us, as well as several provider groups. In addition to those, our primary contractor for design, development, and implementation is EDS. The contract with EDS began in 2005, and that contract is in basically two pieces. One is to develop and implement the system, and secondly is to operate and maintain the system from a systems point of view once we go live. The total contract value is $72 million, of which $44 million is for the initial development and implementation. To oversee EDS's work, we have a quality assurance contractor, which is Fox Systems. Fox Systems was brought on board 3 months before EDS in order to work with DHS to manage this project. To date, they've been doing an excellent job in providing oversight and the review of EDS's deliverables and progress. Now, earlier I had the question about what is the impact on providers, and I appreciate the comments about the needed improvements, not only in the submission, going away from the submission of paper claims towards electronic claim submission and other electronic capabilities, as well as enabling the field, DHS field offices, to automatically do certain functions versus using a paper bureaucratic approach to submitting requests for payment. So providers are going to see a major impact in the changes. There are three other stakeholders that will see benefit from a new MMIS. Policymakers, such as this committee, will have access to data online as it relates to the past expenditure of Medicaid payments. It will also allow DHS in a what-if analysis. If a certain policy were to be made, what would be the impact of implementing that policy? The new system has a test environment which will allow the new policy to be implemented to see what the financial impact of certain policies decisions would be. DHS, as it was talked to earlier, currently has siloed information systems that support many different separate programs. This MMIS will be one of the early systems that provide a Medicaid solution or a solution to completing certain business processes throughout the department. And we see significant efficiencies as it relates to implementing an enterprise-wide functionality. And then finally, CMS requires that the MMIS be federally certified, and they've increased their certification requirements recently, and this new system will allow us to meet those requirements.
Madam Chair, I particularly like this chart, so thank you for providing it. It might be helpful to also put clients as a stakeholder group. Intuitively, we know they all benefit from everything running better, but in terms of just, you know, what our focus at the end is, clients who have, it's a better delivery system, so might want to just add them on the table. Thanks.
My final chart gives a summary of what we've accomplished to date. Utilizing participation from over 400 stakeholders, we have defined in detail over 1,700 requirements to meet the functionality of the new system. We have defined the new business processes to be used by providers and by DHS in implementing the system throughout the department. We've developed a plan and shared the plan with providers on how we're going to transition them from the way that we operate with the current MMIS to the way that we'll need to operate with the future MMIS. And we've also put the plan together for how DHS will transform ourselves with processing under the new business rules. We've taken a portion of the system, which is called the Electronic Document Management System, and as a pilot project, this subsystem has already gone through the entire development process and was implemented last November and is currently in operation. We did this pilot project for a couple of different reasons, the first of which was to test our ability to deliver a system related to Medicaid, and for DHS as well as the contractor to learn what it was going to take to do that. That implementation was challenging, it was tough, but we have accomplished it, and this pilot project is currently in operations. Finally, as I mentioned earlier in my presentation, we're currently in the design phase of the project. We've reviewed the design and have accepted a portion of the design. We are working diligently and closely with completing the design as our next major milestone. We are currently projecting an implementation in the spring of 2008.
Thank you.
I'm open for any questions.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, could you explain how, if at all, the hope of having online applications for Oregon Health Plan and Healthy Kids and other things are going to be, I'm assuming that's in the discussion as well with the new system. This will make it a lot easier to do, I would assume.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, one of the things that we've learned from the power of the system that's being transferred from Oklahoma is that it has the ability to predefine benefit plans. And as new policy is defined, we can define a new benefit plan and add it to the system without making major IT changes to the system. Namely, the DHS policy staff can define a new benefit plan and implement it without the need for significant IT impact. And so to answer your question is, yes, we are already projecting, as we look at potential bills that would pass, we're looking at, as it relates to the amount of changes needed for the new MMIS, the majority of those can be made without IT impact.
That's great. Thank you.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you for coming today and your testimony, and clearly you spent a lot of time preparing. This was very helpful to me and very interesting. And, Madam Chair, I wanted to thank you for devoting mm-hmm. the time to do this. And I hope maybe we can share some of this information with our friends on the Government Accountability and Information Technology
yes.
Committee. This might be of tremendous yes. interest to them as well.
Indeed. I found it fascinating. I learned about what I don't know. It's very, very interesting. And I have, if nobody else has anything, I have a last question. What can we in the legislature do to facilitate what it is you are trying to do? And what can we do to make your lives easier?
And Madam Chair, members, I think you're already doing that, frankly, by what has happened here today to provide a forum for us to come and share our challenges and the mitigation strategies that we have developed with you. And again, getting your feedback, because we don't know all the answers and we don't know exactly at times what the expectations are. I sense that, you know, things are getting better. Communication is opening up and we are having better exchange of information. But, you know, specifically, I would say that if any of you have any questions or doubts at any time that we are being transparent around the information that we are presenting, it would take a simple phone call, you know, to either, you know, Dr. Goldberg or myself or you know, Clyde Psyche, our Deputy of Operations, and we can certainly present to you what it is that we're working on. I think quite often we operate on different assumptions, and, you know, that is something that contributes to perhaps uncertainty. And not working off the same page or the same sheet of music, as the same.
So could you give us your phone number? We know how to reach Dr. Goldberg.
Absolutely. 503-945-5781.
Great. Thank you so much.
One final comment, and, you know, we rarely get an opportunity to do this. And this is related to the MMIS project. It is the biggest project, IT project in the state. And it is the most difficult project to manage as far as project management aspect. It is very difficult to find individuals who can manage that size of IT project. And in all honesty, most likely folks who can manage those kinds of projects don't come to work for us because we can't pay them enough. And I just want to take a moment and recognize Jim Joyce, because he has actually been recognized by Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services as one of the premier project managers in the nation on the MMIS project, and we are getting continuous phone calls from other states around project management practices. Again, given we cannot pay bonuses, this is the most I can do.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Madam Chair. But yes. What we can do is rent his services to other states.
When he's done.
What a substantial profit.
We take that under advisement.
Any further questions or comments from the committee? Thank you again, gentlemen. It was a great presentation. Thank you so much. And with that, I will close the informational meeting on data collection and management systems. And I'm going to reopen the work session on HJR 34. And I'm going to remove Representative Kotek from carrying the bill and put Bruce Hanna as the carrier of that bill. So thank you. And unless we have anything good for the order, Representative Gilliam, looks like you. Okay, all right. Anything else? I will close the hearing. Human Services and Women's Meldus, thank you for sticking around.